السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. أما بعد. So before we begin, quick. Now we'll skip a pop quiz. We'll just start, inshallah. طيب. So today we're going to be covering a number of topics. We're going to be covering the persecution that the Muslims faced in Mecca, how they went for asylum in Abyssinia, some relief that they received through the reversion or conversion of two very important people, the political tactics that were used by the Quraysh against the Muslims, and the boycott and the sanctions, which was a phase that Muslims had to go through as well. So, starting with the persecution. Now keep in mind the scenario. This is the situation in which we are. We're in a scenario and we're in a situation which the revelation has come to the Prophet ﷺ. He began with the secret call for a period of 3 years. And he began to call people secretly and people who he could trust. And then the command came from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through revelation, telling him that he must proclaim his message openly to people. So he began and he ascended the hill and he started calling other people, and people began accusing him in different ways. They began calling him a liar, they began calling him insane, they began challenging him, and they had many different reasons why they were rejecting the message of Islam. Now remember that it began with name calling, and it began with insults, and it began with propaganda, and they were very concerned that at the time of the pilgrimage, there was going to be a spread of Islam to all the other tribes throughout Arabia. And they did not want to allow that to happen. And this is very important that we understand how persecution begins. Persecution never begins overnight in any civilization or in any society. Persecution begins with insults. It begins with mockery. It begins with other political tactics first, and then it moves forward to the state of persecution, and that's where the Muslims are coming through at this time. So first, the believers are openly mocked about their beliefs. Not only the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ was being criticized, but his followers started to be criticized as well. So now you imagine a Muslim's walking down the street, and now the Muslim is being made fun of just for being a Muslim. And you see that they're going to the Kaaba to pray, and they're being made fun of just because they're praying in the way that Muslims are praying. So this is a problem that's taking place. And it's a problem that began initially by accusing Islam, and now it's accusing all people who follow the religion of the Prophet ﷺ. So the believers are being openly mocked by people. Now imagine the scenario. Imagine the situation where you're walking down the street and somebody starts throwing something at you, not hurting you, but just making fun of you, spitting in your direction while you're walking down the street. They're doing something, mocking you or making fun of you. Very, very difficult. This is psychological trauma that Muslims were having to go through at this time. It's not easy. Now, that's where it started in the beginning. Then what happened? The next phase and the next thing that happened was the Quraysh began to torture the people who were slaves, the Muslims who were slaves, and the Muslims who are poor. Now the question is, why would they start with these people? Right? Why not just start persecuting Muslims immediately? Well, the thing is, they wanted to make sure that they would persecute Muslims who would not be able to fight back, and no non-Muslims would be able to kind of defend them because they don't have any clout, because they don't have any people to back them up. And if the Muslims who had that honor or had that reputation, they would also not be able to back them up because their tribe would be willing to support them, but they would not be willing to support some foreigner who has no status or no position. And their tribe is still not Muslim yet. So this is the way it works, and this is the way it began. And it's very interesting, if you just look at all the parallels, I hope some people are already making the connections in terms of how persecution begins, how Islamophobia begins to take place in a society, for example. The same thing's happening. And you start with the people who are not able to do something about it. The people who no one's going to miss if you kind of, you know, kidnap them and put them in some kind of, you know, prison or torture chamber or whatever it is. So the same kind of tactics have been used throughout history, and the same tactics were being used in Makkah at that time. So you have some examples now. You have a few examples that we're going to mention of some of the slaves or some of the weak people and what kind of persecution they went through. Bilal ibn Rabah, one of the early Muslims. Bilal was a slave. Okay, he was a slave, and he was a slave from Africa, from, you know, Ethiopia, that kind of region. And he had come into Mecca, don't know his exact details of his story, but he's a black slave living inside Mecca. Now, by the way, slavery in Arabia was not like slavery in America. Slavery was equal opportunity. So whether you're black, or whether you're Arab, or whether you're Roman, or whether you're Persian, you could still be made a slave. It was not only race-based. So Bilal just happened to be black, though. He happened to be an African slave who is sitting in Mecca, and he's owned. He's been purchased by someone, and the person who owns him, not a very nice guy. Bilal finds out about Islam. And when he finds out about Islam, he accepts it, and he says, you know what, this is the truth. Now, because of his Islam, what happens to him? In the beginning, you know, how he was living, maybe he had to work hard, maybe he had to do something. Now that he's Muslim, he has a major problem because his quote-unquote master, his owner, hates the Islam that Bilal has. First of all, why does he hate Islam so much? Because slave owners at that time thought that they don't only own the body of the person, they own the soul of the person as well. That's how arrogant the people became at that time. So Bilal became Muslim, and now he's going to be tortured. Here are some of the methods of torture that they applied on him. Number one, they dragged him in the burning sand. Now, how would they drag him? Right? The Quraysh, you know, the people who are torturing, you know, Muslims, they're not going to unnecessarily waste their own energy if they don't have to. So they would not drag him just by themselves. They would either get a bunch of other people to drag him, or they would tie him to an animal and drag him through the burning sand. Now, if you've ever been to Mecca, or if you've ever been a very hot desert climate, and you feel the sand at noontime, you know what it does to your body. Even people who pray on the sand in 115 degrees or 120 degrees heat during noontime, it starts burning your body because it's really, really hot. So he's being dragged through the burning hot sand, right? While his flesh is probably, you know, messing up and, you know, being, you know, whatever type of degree burn he's getting. The second way they tortured him was they took a boulder, a giant rock. I imagine a giant boulder, and they would place it on top of his chest. Just enough that his chest, his bones, his rib cage would not break. But they would be at the point where he can't take it anymore. He can barely breathe, and a giant rock is being placed on him. So while this torture was taking place, not only the rock, while he's being dragged around in the sand, and sometimes he was dragged by his hair, people would be pulling him by his hair. While he's being dragged around, all they're asking him to do is just do one thing. Just leave Islam. That's it. Just leave Islam and renounce Islam and renounce the Prophet, and everything is going to be fine for you. And he did not have to say anything. He could have simply remained quiet. But his faith, his belief was so strong that he started saying, Ahad, Ahad, one, one, meaning that Allah is one. I'm not going to worship these idols. I'm not going to take these idols for worship. Now, I want you to think about Bilal's situation, and if you were in his status, imagine you were in the same position. Would you have the confidence, forget the confidence, would you have the ability to speak up in that aspect? Now see, remember what he's doing. What he's doing is he's being defiant. But why is he being defiant? He's being defiant because of the conviction that he holds inside. His conviction is leading him to say that not only am I going to be willing to get tortured for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, I'm going to even tell you that you're wrong in what you're believing and I'm right in what I'm believing. This is very important, because usually what ends up happening is people are able to deliver a message to another person when they're in a state of superiority over them. If you look at the way propaganda works in society, for example, if you look at the way people who own, you know, radio stations, or there's talking heads on radio talking about their analysis of world events and spewing all of their hate speech or whatever it is. That happens when they're in a position of power. And when people are not in a position of power, they're not willing to speak because they feel that there's going to be repercussions against them. Bilal is flipping the everything around. He's saying that, no, I may be in a state of weakness, extreme weakness in this case, but I'm still the one who's going to be calling you to Islam. I'm still the one who's going to manifest for myself. So imagine what Bilal's doing. He's easing his own pain by reiterating his own conviction and his own belief in Islam. So number one, he's saying ahad, ahad to himself. So that it's very clear in himself that I am 100% sure that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is one, Islam is the truth, and I'm going to remind myself so that this torture doesn't take any effect on my iman, on my belief. Number two, he is calling them, and in a way he's persecuting them, and this is something that people, the subtle point people don't realize. He's being physically tortured, but they hate Islam so much that they're actually being psychologically tortured by Bilal. This is what's happening. He's actually getting them back as well. That's how much of a hatred they have against Islam. So this was this was something that Bilal was going through. Now Abu Bakr, radiallahu anhu, may Allah be pleased with all of these people. Abu Bakr, we already talked about him. He was a philanthropist. He was a businessman. He was a genealogist, all the other stuff we talked about. He was quite wealthy. So when he found out that Bilal and other slaves among the Muslims were being tortured like this, some of them were being beaten, some of them were having to go through all of these things, he started purchasing these slaves and setting them free. So he came by and he bought Bilal and he bought six other slaves as well that we know of for sure. And perhaps even more than that. So Abu Bakr didn't go through the same torture, but what did he do? He eased the torture of other people and he spent his money for the sake of Allah by purchasing these slaves. So many lessons to learn. That if you're not in that position, you may be in another position where you can help somebody in that case. If you're not being tortured yourself, then you can utilize your wealth or utilize your time or utilize your efforts to help somebody who is undergoing that type of torture. So Abu Bakr's father comes to him. He was not a believer. Being a, you know, kind of materialistic person, he says, you know, you could use all that money that you have to at least, you know, if you're going to believe in Islam, fine. You have money, you want to spend it for the sake, you know, for the sake of Islam, fine. If you're going to free some slaves, can't you at least free some strong slaves so that they could at least work for you? This is what he's saying. Because Bilal was not one of the really strong people. He was not one of the big, you know, those big slaves who could like do some lot of work or something. So at least free some of the big slaves so that they could work for you. And Abu Bakr said, I'm not doing this so that they can benefit me. I'm doing this completely for the sake of Allah. See, sometimes your intention will be that, you know what? You can do this for the sake of Allah, but you can also get this other great thing. And then everyone's thinking, oh, that's great, you know? If that other incentive is there, alhamdulillah, you know? But if the other incentive's not there, maybe I won't do this thing purely for the sake of Allah. But Abu Bakr had this sincerity in him. So he began to free these slaves for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he would free them completely. Another example of persecution was Khabbab ibn al-Arad. Khabbab was another slave. And Khabbab was a blacksmith. So a blacksmith is somebody who, you know, works in the, you know, metal industry, and they're, you know, hitting the swords, and they're shaping the metal and everything around the fire. So Khabbab, what did they make him do? They made him, his torture was, number one, he would lie on burning hot coals. Because he would have coals in the place where he works. So they would make him lie in burning hot coals and he would be burnt. And in fact, it's reported that he was burnt so badly that sometimes the fat from his body was dripping off because he was being burned. And the fat would drip off and go on the coal and extinguish the coal. That's how bad he was actually being tortured. And then another way they tortured him was people would come and stand on top of him. So they would like stand on him like he's a human carpet. So they would step on him, they would stand on him. And there's another report as well that they would take the sword that, you know, that was being burnt in the fire and they would brand him with that. Imagine burning hot metal, and they would come and they would brand him with that. And later on, a few years later, when they moved to Medina and all of that, he goes and he starts showing the scars to the other Muslims. He's changing his shirt one day, and people look at him and they say, "What in the world happened to you?" They say, "Oh, you've never seen this before. This was during the time in Mecca when I was being tortured. All of these scars on my back are from that torture." And that's when people started respecting Khabbab more. So he didn't go and show it off in the beginning, but when somebody saw it one time, they started respecting him even more. So now the interesting thing about this though, Khabbab is being tortured like this. So he goes to the Prophet ﷺ, who's sitting in front of the Kaaba one day, and he goes up to him and he says, "Ya Rasulullah, you know, why don't you pray for us? Why don't you, you know, ask Allah for victory for us? No, we can get out of this. We're being tortured. It's so difficult for us." Now, you would imagine what the answer would be. I mean, this is not, given the circumstances, it seems like this is not an unfair request. It's very difficult, right? Instead of being tortured. What does the Prophet ﷺ answer? He said, "O Khabbab," that people in the past would have their flesh torn apart with iron rakes. Now, just think about that. You have a rake, imagine, and your flesh is being torn apart with iron rakes, but they never abandoned their religion. Meaning they never abandoned their belief in Allah. We're talking about a generation of Muslims that lived in the past, and this is how they were being tortured. But they never left their faith. So then the Prophet ﷺ says, "Don't worry. Allah will establish this religion and make peace in the land, but you people are too hasty." Can you imagine? He's telling Khabbab, "You people are too hasty." Because Khabbab came in a state of desperation. What does it mean? It means that there has to be certain tests in life. And there has to be certain trials and certain difficulties that the Muslim ummah, that the Muslim community has to go through in order to get through that other stage. And the Prophet ﷺ is telling them at a stage where they're being tortured and they're persecuted. He's not saying that nothing's going to happen. It's going to happen. But this is a stage that we must pass. You must be patient in this stage. Huge lesson. Huge, huge lesson to be learned. Ammar ibn Yasir and his parents were among the earliest believers as well. So Ammar and his parents, they are not from Mecca. So remember, if you're not from Mecca, some sources say that they were slaves. Some say that, no, they were not really saved. They were just foreigners. So they were not from Mecca, meaning they didn't have their roots rooted in Mecca. Therefore, they're weak. And therefore, it's very easy to persecute them as well. So what happened? Ammar is being tortured. And his family is being tortured as well. Okay, his father, Yasir, and his mother, Sumayya, are both being tortured. Now, while they're being tortured, the Prophet ﷺ walked by one day. And what did he say? He said, "Have patience, O family of Yasir, and you will have paradise." Have patience, O family of Yasir, and you will have paradise. A very important question arises. What was the Prophet ﷺ doing? Why didn't he just, you know, just run in there and try to attack somebody? Why didn't he throw a rock at some, you know, the first people? This is a fellow Muslim who's being tortured, right? What should have been done in this state? Why is the Prophet ﷺ simply walking by and he's not doing anything about it? And all he's saying, the thing that he's doing, it's not he's doing nothing. He's telling them, "Have patience, and if you have patience, you will have paradise." Who can answer this question? It's a very, very legitimate question, right? Why not just charge in there and just do something about it? Okay, might have eased some of their suffering. It was not a strategic move, and you have to go through strategic moves. Yes. He knew it was a test from Allah. That's right. Okay, that's it's a test from Allah, but then strategy is very, very important as well. Yeah. He wasn't commanded yet by Allah. These are all correct answers. He wasn't yet commanded by Allah. It's a test for that person from Allah. And the strategy was not there. So Allah had not revealed to them yet to fight back. What else? So if they would have fought, the Quraysh might have actually gotten more aggressive and the entire thing would be messed up. Now even more people, even the middle class people, would start being tortured maybe. Maybe something else would happen. So it was a point in time where this was not the time to fight back. Meaning that there are times where you don't necessarily fight back. And that's why the ulama say that if you're on the battlefield and you know that you can inflict no harm or no damage upon the enemy, or virtually no damage upon the enemy, what do? You're allowed to leave. You're allowed to flee. Even though the Quran says clearly that if you turn your backs on the enemy, if you're in the battlefield, it's one of the greatest sins, except in certain circumstances. Meaning there are exceptions to the rule. Now, how do you determine all of that? You have to make a very important judgment call. But understand that the Prophet ﷺ was teaching. Not only was he doing something, had he charged in and done something, everyone else would follow his example and they would do the exact same thing. And what would happen? There could be disastrous consequences. So this is very, very important to understand that there's a time and a place for everything. And that's why wisdom is defined as doing the right thing and saying the right thing at the right time and in the right place. Not saying the thing, so saying a nice thing in the wrong time or in the wrong place. So the Prophet ﷺ passed by and he told him, "Have patience, O family of Yasir." Now Sumayya, his Yasir's mother, she was being tortured as well. And these were all believers. And this was a very old woman. And Yasir was an old man as well. So they were all being tortured. And Abu Jahl, we're going to talk about him soon, he became one of the worst enemies and opponents of Islam, against Islam. He was torturing her and he was saying, you know, leave Islam. Worship these idols and putting the idols in front of her. And what did he do? He got really upset when she refused. And she refused in a very firm and solid way. And she even insulted him. So he got so upset that he grabbed a spear and he stabbed it through her genitals. And she died. She died bleeding. So this is the first martyr in Islam. The first martyr in Islam was a woman who died for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the Prophet ﷺ said she's going to be guaranteed paradise. So we have so far, if we take Khadija as being the first believer in Islam, is a woman. We have the first martyr in Islam is a woman. And we're going to talk about some other interesting thing about different women going through. So Abu Jahl stabbed her and she died. Now Ammar, he saw this. He saw his parents being tortured. He just saw his mom being killed. And he's, you know, kind of young and everything. So he couldn't take it anymore. He couldn't take it anymore, and they're saying, we're going to stop all of this torture. Because they were racking him. Racking is a type of torture that was used where they tie your arms and legs and they stretch you in both directions. Extremely, extremely painful. Excruciating pain. So they were racking him, and basically that's when he gave in. And he said, okay, what do you want me to do? And they started telling him, we want you to say that you don't believe in Islam. He said, okay, I don't believe in Islam. And we want you to say you worship this idol. He said, okay, I worship this idol. And then they started making fun of him so much, and then a little bug was passing by, and we want you to say that this little bug is your God. And he said, okay, this little bug is my God. And they started torturing him in this way, even psychological torture. But they said, okay, we'll stop if you give in. So Ammar, he gave in. He gave in, and after he gave in, he was let go. So he survived the ordeal. His mother is dead. What happened to his father exactly? Not 100% sure. So Ammar comes out, and now he's feeling horrible because he realizes that he just renounced Islam. He just gave up his Islam. Bilal is being tortured. Bilal didn't give in. Khabbab is being tortured. Khabbab didn't give in. His mom and dad are being tortured. They didn't give in. But he gave in. So now he's thinking, I'm outside the fold of Islam. I've left Islam, I've betrayed the Muslim, I've betrayed the Prophet ﷺ, there's nothing I can do. So he's feeling extremely bad. Finally, the Prophet ﷺ finds out that this is what happened. He sends somebody to tell Ammar, says, bring him over here. He says, Ammar, did you actually believe what you said when you said it? And he said, no, Ya Rasulullah. Of course not. I didn't believe that. I mean, I was just saying that to get myself out of being tortured. I did not mean it. I still believe in Allah and I still believe in you as a prophet and all of that. So the Prophet ﷺ, he told him, he said that it's what's in your heart that matters most. And he said, if they torture you again, you go ahead and you say the same thing to avoid the torture. showing you two different examples. And then the verses of the Quran were revealed, where it says, with the exception of those who are forced to say that they do not believe, although their hearts remain firm in faith. So it's talking about people who disbelieve. And it says, the exception to the rule is those who are forced to say with their tongues that they don't believe, but their hearts remain firm in faith. So what do you have here? You have two examples. You have the example of the one that's being tortured and is maintaining their Islam proudly despite all of those difficulties. And then you have the one person who's being tortured and they can't take it anymore. And they say, verbally, I'm going to give in, but in my heart, I'm going to remain. I want you to ask yourself this question. Which one would you do? You don't have to answer it. Just think about it. Which one would you do? And then the next question is, which one should you do Islamically, according to Islamic law, according to Sharia? Which one should you do? And the reality is that the scholars have differed. Scholars have a difference of opinion. Now, one of the schools of thought says that you get much more reward if you go ahead and you take the pain and you take the torture. And the other one says, no, you should, after this verse was revealed, that was a time for them. And now, if you're being tortured to a point where you can't take it anymore, you're supposed to. You should go ahead and just stop the torture if you can. Now, what does torture mean, by the way? Torture doesn't mean that you're getting a few punches over here, right? Or somebody comes and says, well, you know, I'm gonna fine you $5,000 or something like that. That's not torture. We're talking about real torture where you can't bear it anymore. Because some people may take this verse and say, well, you know, we should just, you know, sit inside our house because Islamophobia is on the rise. We shouldn't speak about Islam at all. Just keep our mouth shut completely and we can't do anything about it. That's not torture. Torture meaning to the point where it's really, really unbearable. Okay? So this is Ammar. Another person who is being tortured is Abu Dharr. Abu Dharr al-Ghifari is another person. Actually, so we're not talking about torture yet. So Abu Dharr al-Ghifari is a person who lives outside of Mecca. So he lives among a tribe known as the Ghifar. And he hears about the Prophet ﷺ. He hears from a source because remember, tribes were going and they made that pilgrimage. And even though all the propaganda, you know, the Quraysh had sent people to spread propaganda around the city of Mecca, obviously some of them still got the information about Islam and what's going on. So Abu Dharr, he had heard from a secondary source. He didn't go to Mecca yet. He heard from somebody from his tribe who came back saying, you know what, the new news in Mecca is that there's a person who's saying that he's a prophet. And he had these verses of the Quran and he's claiming this and he's making this claim. So Abu Dharr was inclined because he was one of those people who had naturally stopped worshipping idols. And he had an inclination against idol worship. And he used to try and, you know, pray in his own way or whatever. We don't know too much about the details. So Abu Dharr, what does he do? He goes and he sends this person from the tribe and he says, I want you to go and find out more information about this. The guy goes to Mecca, finds out the information, brings it back, and he tells them this and this is what happened. Abu Dharr is like, just waiting to find out more. And he said, this is not sufficient. I'm going myself. I have to investigate this matter myself. Very interesting. His character and his personality is very interesting because sometimes people, when they're told about Islam, they say, well, you know, if somebody comes and talks to me about Islam, then that'll be nice. But I'm not willing to go to attend a class. And you say, oh, well, I'm going to send somebody else on my behalf to go and attend the class and learn a little bit about it. But I'm not going to go and travel all the way over there to go and find out something about it. There are people in this world who are kind of waiting for the truth to come to them. And then there are people like Abu Dharr, where they send somebody else and then they come back and they bring some of the message and they say, no, I need more. I'm thirsty for more. I need to go. So Abu Dharr, he goes and he sets out on a journey and he goes to Mecca himself. When he arrives in Mecca, he goes and he starts searching around for the Prophet ﷺ. So he's in Mecca. He stays at the Kaaba. Now think about this. He's not a very wealthy man. He goes to Mecca and he's just sleeping at the Kaaba. He doesn't need anything else. He's living off of Zamzam water. He's just drinking water and just, you know what? I have to find the Prophet. I don't care. Food is not important. He's not interested in going to the local restaurants or the local gatherings or something like that. He's only searching for one thing and one thing only, and that is the truth about Islam. So he's waiting there, and then Ali, right, who is a Muslim, right, he comes and he finds this man, and he's a foreigner, and he's just lying there. He says, "What are you doing here?" And he says, "I'm looking for that man, the Prophet. I'm looking for Muhammad. Can you guide me to him? Can you tell me?" And he said, "You came to the right person." You stumble across the right person. Because if he stumbled across the wrong person and he's not from Mecca, he would get beat up, he would get persecuted, he would get the propaganda. So he encountered the right person, which is very interesting. Because the thing is this, who's the first person he encountered? Ali. Why did he encounter Ali? Because Ali, as a Muslim, his generosity inclined him to ask, "What are you doing here? Can I take care of you? Can I take care of?" In fact, the actual story goes that he took Abu Dharr into his house, not knowing why he's in Mecca in the first place. He took him into his house for hospitality. And after a while, he started asking him, "By the way, you've been here with me for a while. What are you doing here anyways?" And he said, "This is what I'm doing here." He said, "You came to the right spot." Which means what? As a Muslim, if you are reaching out to people, doing good deeds and helping people, naturally, somehow, you'll stumble across some opportunities to be able to convey the message of Islam to other people. So Ali goes and Ali says, "I'm going to show you where the Prophet is. You follow me." And he says, "While you're following me, you follow me from behind." Right? So I'm going to be walking and you follow me from the back. And if you see me, that I stop and I walk up to a corner or I stop to bend down or something, I'll make it look like I'm going to the bathroom or I'm tying my shoes or whatever. I'm going to make it look like I'm doing something else. That means we're being followed. And you stop following me and you go the opposite direction. Now this conversation tells you a lot about what the situation was like at that point in Mecca. It was so dangerous that they couldn't even walk side by side. They had to walk separately. He had to be following him from the back, and he even gave him a signal. Very smart, right? Rather than just saying, "Inshallah, Allah will protect us. Everything's going to be fine. Let's go." No, intelligence. They were using the things that the Prophet ﷺ taught them. So they're walking to where the Prophet ﷺ was going to be. So Ali radiallahu anhu, he covertly led him to the Prophet ﷺ. As soon as he entered, he learned about Islam. He immediately accepted. Immediately accepted Islam. Islam had entered into his heart. He heard the Quran. Extremely convinced this is exactly what he had been searching for. It's exactly what he had been waiting for years. So now that he's Muslim, the Prophet ﷺ tells him, right? Now imagine all the things that the Prophet could tell him. He could tell him, "Look, we're very few right here. We need you. We need you to stay with us. We need you to help strengthen us. We need you to work for us. We need you to do something." He didn't say that. At this point in time, in the mission of Islam, he said, "What you need to do, you keep your Islam a secret. You go back home to your people. And when we contact you again, when I contact you, then you start, you come, basically. But now is not the time. We don't need you here. You don't stay in Mecca. You stay quiet with your Islam. Go back home. Tell your people. But don't come back to Mecca until we tell you." Strategy. He knows. The Prophet ﷺ knows what's going on. But Abu Dharr was the type of person who can't keep it inside. When you're excited about something, it shows you his love for Islam. When you're excited about something, and many new Muslims, for example, they come and they tell me, they say, they just accepted Islam. And I said, "Look, one of my advices to you is, test your family a little bit. Okay, ask them, what do they think about Islam? Or, just tell them, mom, dad, I have a friend of mine who accepted Islam. What do you think?" And they're like, "Oh, I hate that religion and this and that. I don't want you to be his friend anymore." Maybe you shouldn't be telling them that you've accepted Islam just yet until you're independent yourself. But many of them, they don't take that advice. They go ahead and do it anyways. And then sometimes they get kicked out of their house. Sometimes they're encountering the most difficult circumstance and situation. This is something to learn from. The Prophet ﷺ is telling them what? He's telling him, keep your Islam secret at this point in time and just go back home and we're going to contact you. We'll let you know what to do next. Inshallah, this is sufficient for you now. And he says, no, no, I have to announce this publicly. So he goes straight to the Kaaba. And the Kaaba is the place where everyone is going to be. So he goes straight to the Kaaba and he gets up and he announces in front of everyone, oh Quraysh and all the people, I have accepted Islam. And immediately they jump on him and they start beating him up and everything. And you think, okay, man, this guy got beat up. Somebody intervened and, you know, got him off. And they say, whoa, 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 do you know who this guy is? This guy is from the tribe of Ghifar. Okay, now why is the tribe of Ghifar important? The tribe of Ghifar were the gangsters of the time, right? They were the guys who stay on the paths. And when a caravan goes through, they would loot the caravan, right? So you have to, you know, you have to, if you're going through their territory, you either pay them or you're going to get robbed. So they go, do you know this guy from the tribe of Ghifar? You continue to, if he dies, your merchandise is gone, right? You guys are going to be in trouble. So they stop beating him up. So now you would think, right, that the Prophet ﷺ told him not to do this. Now he just got beat up. So you think, okay, this guy is going to go back home. He's taking a beating. It's going to be sufficient. So what does he do instead? The next day, he goes to the Kaaba again, and he says, I'm going to announce again. And he announces publicly again, I have accepted Islam, and I'm a Muslim. So, I mean, imagine what kind of faith he has. He's not making the right decision, but he's doing it out of love, right? So another group of people who weren't there yesterday, they jump him, and they start beating him up and everything. And finally, the guys come and they get him off. This guy's from Ghifar, man. You don't want to get messed up. And they say, you know, can you please stop doing this? Because we may not be able to save you if you do it again tomorrow. So two times after a beating, he decides, okay, fine. I've got it out of my system a little bit, you know. I'm feeling good now. So he decides, okay, I'm going to go back home now. So he goes back home and alhamdulillah. Now at this point in time, many people are entering into Islam. Now many Muslims were keeping their Islam a secret because of the situation in Mecca at that time. And this was not only something that it was allowed, it was something that the Prophet ﷺ recommended for especially the people who were in a weaker position. Why? Because there were spies all around Mecca. So even if you try to keep your Islam a secret, how can somebody find out about your Islam? What's the best way for somebody to figure out that you're a Muslim? I heard it. Prayer, right? They see you praying. And you're praying differently than everyone else is going to be praying at the Kaaba or whatever they were doing. So they can tell, if they catch you praying somewhere, they know, okay, this guy is a Muslim. So this is why it was very, very difficult for a lot of people, and people were getting caught. A lot of people were getting exposed because they were caught praying. And when they were caught praying, they said, this person has accepted Islam, and they were being tortured. Okay? Any questions? Absolutely, yes. A very good question. So how did they get to this point where they're accepting Islam and they're ready to die for it, whereas other people are taking Islam for granted? First of all, keep in mind, given these circumstances, everyone here, everyone at this time is a convert. So no one is born into the religion just because their parents are that way or they think that it's inherited or something. So no one's going to take it for granted, number one, because every single person is choosing Islam, number one. Number two, they're choosing Islam in an atmosphere where everything is anti-Islam. So the people who are coming into Islam, right, they're only going to be the people who are extremely, extremely dedicated already in the first place. Otherwise, they would not have come out with Islam. Most other people who are not accepting Islam and they're not fighting against Islam, they're kind of taking like a wait and see attitude, right? Like, let's see what happens. You know, if this becomes a really big thing, then maybe we'll jump in. And if not, then, you know, this happens all the time. Like, for example, like our college, right? Alhamdulillah, a lot of people joined. A lot of people ask them, say, why didn't you join our college? Well, you know, it's new and I'm waiting to see if it's going to be really successful or good or something. A lot of people waiting on the sidelines. I'm not committed to jump in just yet. So a lot of people are kind of waiting. So these are some of the reasons. And the other reasons are that they would take the verses from the Quran. And remember, we talked about the type of verses from the Quran that were coming. They were the hard-hitting verses, right? That were really telling them to wake up, to change their life, to adjust themselves to Allah. you know, the, all of these things played a major factor. So that's why these are not the people who are taking it for granted. You will find near the end of Islam, when Islam was becoming very popular and Muslims had amassed, you know, larger armies and everything, you will find people coming into Islam who are taking it for granted. But at this point in time, anyone who planned on taking it for granted would not have come into Islam in the first place because of the dangers that were involved. Which shows you that when people go and accept Islam against all odds and against everything, against their family, against their society, against every circumstance, generally they tend to be at a higher level of dedication than someone who just, everything's easy. Like you're born in the court, you know, a royal court or something, and everything just served to you like on a golden platter. It's very different. It's very different. All right, very good question. Yes. Yes, we could say the Prophet was in front of them as well, that helped, but the reason why I don't like to answer that way is because people say, oh, because the Prophet was in front of them, so it's okay for us to be like this, because the Prophet is not in front of us. That's not the way to think. That's not the best way to think. Okay, so you're saying, let's say, you're being harmed, but you're not being tortured, and you want to get out of it by, let's say, verbally renouncing Islam because your mother would be sad if you were hurt in any way. Or like your arm gets broken or something and you can't work anymore.
Sure.
Okay. Right, but let's, okay. The thing is, if someone else is going to be directly affected, right, then yes, you can take it into consideration. But the thing is, if someone is, if your mom is saying that, you know what, I don't want any harm to come to you. And they're coming and they're saying, you know, we're going to inflict, you know, paper cut wounds on you, right? And he said, my mom would be really, really upset if she found out about this. Therefore, I'm going to renounce my Islam, you know, in front of them. It's not a legitimate reason. Because, yes, your mother will be, you know, sad about that. But at the same time, a bruise, you can handle a bruise, right? You can handle a cut or something like that. But if it gets to a point where it's really going to be unbearable, then it's something else. When it comes to a point where they're going to break your arm or something, and you need that arm because, let's say, you're a computer programmer and you're not going to be able to, you know, continue your job, and then your family will be affected. That's a legitimate thing. But if you're just going to, you know, let's not go into waterboarding examples and all of that, you know. But it's tough. It's torture, but it just depends how many times you're going to be waterboarded, right? Because it's not going to kill. It's not going to kill you, right? So, I mean, it's torture. There's no doubt about it. But how many times? Like, if it's like, you know, Guantanamo, they do like 650 times a year. That's a lot of waterboarding, you know. But it just depends. Right? Depends. I mean, in your case, just call Contact Care. I would recommend that. Contact Care, and they'll give you advice, and they'll also follow up with why, you know, your students are not allowed to do that. So they'll give you good advice, inshallah. All right, let's continue, inshallah. So, asylum in Abyssinia. So now, we're talking about the fifth year. It's very important to keep your timeline in date. So the first 3 years of the Prophet ﷺ's call, secret call. Fourth year, public call. What else took place? Persecution, ridicule, propaganda had begun already, right? Now we're into the fifth year. So in the fifth year of the call, the Prophet ﷺ saw that persecution is taking place. Muslims, the weaker ones, are being persecuted. People are rejecting Islam. People are making fun of Islam. Very difficult situation. So the Prophet ﷺ recommended that Muslims, a lot of the Muslims, migrate to a place called Abyssinia. Now Abyssinia is around modern-day Ethiopia. Why? Because there was a person by the name of Negus or An-Najashi, right? That was not his name, but that was his title. And he was a just king. He was a just ruler, and he was a Christian, and he was ruling over that land. And we talked about Abyssinia a little bit when we talked about the history. Remember, Abyssinia teamed up with the Roman Empire to remove who from power? The Jews. From Yemen. Very good. From Yemen. All right. So we talked about them a little bit. They're also a smaller kind of small empire. But they're Christian. Therefore, they have a lot of cooperation with the Romans, who happen to be Christian as well. And they're next to Egypt because the Romans had conquered Egypt, and Ethiopia is just below that a little bit. So they had a kingdom over there. And this king, the Prophet ﷺ had heard about him. He knew about him. Which means what? Which means that this, you know, whether this was revelation or not, we don't exactly know. But the Prophet ﷺ recommended that whoever would like to migrate should migrate. It means that he was keeping in touch with what's going around in the world. Right? He was not just sitting in Mecca himself, not caring what's going on. He understood what's going on around the world. He understood that there's a person here. And he said, look, this is a Christian, and he's a king, and he's known to be a just king. And he's known to be someone who, you know, doesn't wrong people. And he has a very, very good reputation. So he gives advice to the Muslims, and he says, whoever would like to migrate, you don't have to be one of the people who are being tortured. You can still go ahead and migrate. So whoever would like to migrate can migrate. First migration, over a dozen Muslims migrated. Even the Prophet's daughter, Ruqayya, which tells you what? Which tells you that the situation was pretty bad. Situation was pretty bad if his own daughter would even be migrating. Now his daughter, Ruqayya, was married to who? Does anyone know? Uthman, right? So Uthman ibn Affan was actually a very wealthy person, and not very powerful, but quite wealthy and quite well off. Now the fact that he's migrating as well means that the situation even for him was quite difficult. And even he was undergoing some form of persecution. Not from the political angle, not from the top people, but from his own clan, from his own family. So what ended up happening is that the people who are in power in Mecca, they're the ones who are persecuting and torturing the weakest people. But does that mean that the people who are in a good position are off the hook? No. Their own family can go ahead and torture them. So they can go ahead and mess with them or do whatever they want and cause them as many problems as they want. So over a dozen Muslims, they migrated to Abyssinia. Now when they migrated to Abyssinia, they reached there. Two envoys from the Quraysh were sent to go and follow them and sent to bring them back. Actually, before that, an entire army was sent. A small, like, call it a battalion or whatever, a brigade, was sent to go and bring the Muslims back. What does that tell you? It tells you that the Quraysh are not just upset now anymore that Islam is in Mecca. They have a problem with Islam, period, wherever it is. So the Muslims should not be going anywhere. Even though they're leaving, the Quraysh shouldn't have a problem. If the problem is, we want power in Mecca, we don't want you here, just get out of here. Now they're leaving. A group of Muslims is leaving, and they don't even want them to leave, so they pursue them. But they make it to the Red Sea, and they cross over, and they make it to Abyssinia before they could get caught. Now that they're there, you would think that everything, you know, they're there, they're living under this Christian king, there's a lot of Christian, you know, there's a Christian land, they're, you know, not really, they're not enjoying themselves in the sense that, you know, they took all their money with them or something. No, it's a difficult life, but at least they can practice Islam. So no one is persecuting them, no one's ridiculing them, because no one knows too much about them. So they weren't doing much. At this point in time, they're not going and telling everyone, but the people were leaving them alone. But the Quraysh are not going to leave them alone. So they send two envoys to go and extradite them and bring them back to Mecca so that they can be tortured. So what do? Very, very smart politicians, right? Before they even arrive in Abyssinia, they know that a lot of merchandise goes through Arabia. It comes from Yemen, comes from Syria, comes from different places. So, and they know what kind of merchandise every group of people likes. People in Syria like certain type of items. People over here like certain type of items. People in Abyssinia, they liked like leather, certain type of leather that was being made that was going through, and they like certain type of items that you can't get over there. So what did they do? They came with all those nice gifts, and before they even went and met with the king, because who makes the final decision, they met with his advisory committee, right? So he has a bunch of advisors. He has like a little council. So the best thing to do is kind of bribe the council. Right, and you say, you know, I've come from Arabia and we're friends. And they were allies as well in a sense. Not because Mecca is not a big player in world history at this time. But they still had decent relations, amicable relations. So they brought all of these gifts to the advisors. Very smart move. And they said, you know what? we just came for a visit and, you know, just seeing how things are. We love you so much and here's all these gifts. So you know that the advisors had been kind of, you know, bought out in a sense without even realizing it. Now they go and they meet the king. A very good political tactic. And this is the speech that was given by one of them, right? Who later on accepted Islam. He said, some young fools have sought refuge in your kingdom. Now if you analyze just the wording, it's beautiful, right? Some young fools have sought refuge in your kingdom. Okay, so first they're being called fools in the beginning. They left the religion of their people, but they didn't enter your religion either. So they're not from us and they're not from you either. Very, very smart. It says, they have come with a fabricated religion. Now that time, tradition was a very, very important thing. It's not like today's society where everything new is good. This old is gold at that time, right? So they have come with a fabricated religion, which neither of us recognizes. We have so much in common. You know, they left our religion. They didn't even enter your religion. None of us knows about this new religion that they're coming with. The noble men among their people have sent us to you to return them home. So meaning they're the fools, and the noble people, the nice, good citizens of Makkah, have sent us to you so that you can return them home. Who are these noble people? The parents, the uncles, the family members. They know, they just want them back and they're going to, you know, handle them. They're going to deal with them. Really, really intelligent speech. This is what you call beautiful, beautiful propaganda here. Beautiful way of convincing somebody. So what happened here? The advisors are there and they're already bribed. So the advisors, they're looking at this and yes, absolutely. You know, it's their family. You know, it's the uncles are sending them. And these people, what's wrong? I mean, they're fools. They've messed up and send them back. And you know, we don't want to deal with these people. Why do you want to have these kind of people sitting in your kingdom? They're just going to cause problems and their families missing them. And have some mercy on the family. So then Najashi was a just king and he was a very smart king as well. So he got upset. Why did he get upset? Because he did not ask his council for their advice. They're supposed to wait, but they've been bought out and they're like, yeah, this is a good idea, this is a good idea. So Najashi is upset and he says, I'm not going to simply make a decision without hearing these people first. So what do they do? Ja'far, who was Ali's brother, he spoke. Remember, Ali was adopted or taken into the house of the Prophet ﷺ. Ja'far was taken into the house of one of the other uncles, okay, Abbas. And he was the son of Abu Talib as well. So Ja'far, very eloquent, knowledgeable about the Quran, he spoke. And this is the long lecture that he gave, okay? We can analyze it. We have a little bit of time to analyze it. So he says, dear king, we were an ignorant people. We worshipped idols and ate the meat of dead animals. Now, the reason why we're going to analyze this, by the way, is this is a beautiful way to present Islam to other people. And I want you to understand the lessons just from this speech on how you can present Islam, especially when somebody is coming and just gave a beautiful speech against you. Right? This is really beautiful if you analyze it. He said, dear king, first of all, addressing the king with respect, even though he's not a Muslim, even though they don't believe in the same thing, he's still giving him the respect of his status. Meaning that when a Muslim is addressing someone, we don't say, you know, in the sight of Allah, you're just a servant. So we're all servants of Allah. So I'm going to call you abd, right? I'm going to call you slave of Allah, you know, and I'm going to address you that way instead of Mr. President or whatever it is. He used the language that, you know, would show him some respect. He said, dear king, we were an ignorant people. We're not the foolish one. This is what we were. So he's going to describe what their history was. He said, we were an ignorant people. We worshipped idols. Okay? The king can relate to that. Because in Christianity, worshipping of idols outside of, outside of that is not allowed. It's also something that they have. He said, we worshipped idols. We ate the meat of dead animals, meaning like animals that had not been slaughtered or anything. We were used to lewd behavior, breaking family ties, and harming neighbors. The strong among us oppressed the weak. explaining what their life was before Islam. Really beautiful. This is how we lived until God sent a messenger to us whose nobility and honesty we had been fully aware of. So now he's explained the past. This is what we came from. Imagine what's going on in the king's mind. This is sick, man. What kind of savage existence are they coming from? These are messed up people. And then he's saying, until God sent, now he can relate to God, to Allah, until Allah sent a messenger to us whose nobility and honesty we were aware of. So nobody can mess with his nobility, nobody can mess with his honesty. The other two envoys are there and they're sitting there and they're listening, they can't question these two things because they also acknowledge them. And then he says, we've been fully aware of, he called us to worship the only God and give up our inherited worship of statues and idols. Something that he's just conveyed the message of Islam while at the same time saying something that the king would actually not disagree with either. He told us to speak the truth, to fulfill promises, to keep family relations, and to be kind to neighbors. Now who can mess with that? I mean, explaining the akhlaq of Islam. This is really important because sometimes when we come and we explain the message of Islam to someone, say, well, you know, Muslims, what do we believe in? Well, we believe in angels. First thing, we believe in angels and we believe in the qadr of Allah. We believe that Allah is in charge of everything and don't try to understand it. Okay, it's the decree of Allah, and I know it doesn't make sense to some people, but that's what we believe in. And we believe in, you know, we don't eat, you know, this type of thing. We don't eat pork. And why not use wisdom and start with something that someone can relate to and someone can appreciate? This is very intelligent. He told us to speak the truth, fulfill crimes. He forbade us from evil, from bloodshed, from shamelessness, from lies, and from deceit. I mean, so he's saying this is the society we lived in. Look how we've changed. This is what he's telling us. You can't say anything against this. He told us to stop the misappropriation of the property of orphans and to avoid false accusations. You can't mess with it. He told us to pray. Now it comes to a little bit more of the worship type things. He told us to pray, and they can relate to it, to give charity and to fast. Right? So these things are there. We believed in him and we acted on his teachings. So we worshipped only God and no one else. We forbade what was forbidden to us and we made lawful what was made lawful to us. He didn't even go into the other details. We forbade whatever he told. So they've already established a reputation. We forbade whatever he said and we did whatever he told us to do. And this is the reason. This is the reason why our people turned against us. They tortured us. They tried to make us return to worshiping idols instead of God and consider lawful the indecencies that we used to do. So when they oppressed us and we couldn't take it anymore, we sought protection in your land. We chose you over others, hoping that we would be safe here and we would not be oppressed. Beautiful way to end it. I mean, this is really, really clever. Ja'far is very, very intelligent. So he made this speech. Now what happens? Okay? The king is really impressed. And he says, he told them more stuff. And he says, I want to know about this Quran of yours. You know, tell me a little bit more about this Quran. I want to hear something from the Quran. Okay? Now, what did Ja'far do? Ja'far knows the Quran as well. Ja'far could have said, you know, let's recite Surah Al-Fatiha. You know, let's just start with one of those, you know. Or let's go ahead and let's just go with the easy one so it's not long for him or something. Let's go with like Surah Al, you know, Ikhlas or Surah Al-Nas or something like that. No, he specifically chose the verses about something that he would be able to relate to, and he's giving them an explanation of Islam at the same time. So he recited verses from Surah Maryam about Mary. He said, the verses say, in translation, mention in the Quran the story of Mary. She withdrew from her family to a place in the east and secluded herself away. So anyways, without reading all of it, you can read it on your own. He began to talk about Mary. Now, he could have chosen the verses which talk about Isa, about Prophet Jesus, right? But whenever the Quran is talking about the Prophet Jesus, what is he talking about when it talks about Prophet Isa? Usually somewhere along there, and it says, and why are you taking him from worship? Or why are you doing that? He chose Maryam, he chose Mary because this is something they can unite on. The message of Islam has already been given in the beginning. Now is the time where, you know what? Let's see something that we can just relate to. So now he's not watering it down or anything. The message of Islam has been delivered, albeit indirectly, but at the same time, he's going and quoting some verses which the person's going to be able to relate to. He recites these verses from the Quran, and An-Najashi, he begins to cry. He begins to cry. And he's getting the translation of this, by the way. He's just hearing the translation. While hearing the Arabic, and then he hears the translation, he begins to cry. And all of his advisors, they were bishops. They were like religious people as well. They all started crying as well. Which tells you what? It tells you that these people were very sincere and dedicated. These were not, the majority of them were not hypocrites. Najashi, for sure, is not someone who had no feeling. You know, he was someone who really believed, and who someone who really, really believed in Allah, and someone who believed in, you know, Prophet Isa and all of that. And what did he say? He commented and he said, these verses and what was given to Jesus are two rays emanating from the same light. Two rays emanating. So he's seeing, he sees the connection. He says, they're coming from the same light. And then what happens? So this is it. It's done. Okay, I know some of you saw the message. They didn't see it like the second day. It's done. He's saying, you guys are allowed to stay. We're not extraditing you. We're not going to give them up. Now, imagine the two envoys who came, they're very upset. They said, you know, we came all the way here, we gave our gifts, we bribed them, we did all of this, and now we failed. It didn't work. But they're not going to leave without a fight. You can give a good speech, they can give a good speech, but there's always going to be another plan. The enemy will have more plans. You don't just go home and rest and say, we're done. So now, they come up with another plan. Very smart plan. The next day, they go and they tell Najashi, they say, you know what? Something that they didn't tell you, by the way. I say, what is that? I say, do you know what they say about Jesus? About your person who you worship? They say that he's a slave. Right? He's a slave. That's an insult. Right? So Najashi, the way they put it, Najashi's really shocked. I can't believe they hid this from me. You know, they recited the verses and everything. They kept this from me. This is a problem. So he calls them again. He calls them again. And he says, you know, explain this. Are they telling the truth? Ja'far speaks again. And Ja'far is very smart. The way he explains it, he says, we're only going to tell you what our Prophet teaches us and what our Quran teaches us. That Isa is a servant. He's a messenger. He's a servant of Allah. He's a messenger of Allah. He's a word from Allah because he was the way he was created without a father. And he's a spirit from Allah. This is all the things that are mentioned about Isa in the Quran. What does this tell you about Ja'far? It tells you that this person has a deep understanding of the Quran, even though the entire thing has not been revealed yet. It means that he was not just sitting at the session listening to how nicely the Prophet ﷺ recites the Quran. And he was not just memorizing it. He was not just, he knew Arabic, obviously. He's reflecting upon the meanings. And he's thinking, you know what? What is the best way to use everything I know about Prophet Isa in the Quran right now in this situation of mine? Very, very important lesson. How do you take the other verses from the Quran and how do you apply them to your circumstances? This is exactly what he did. So Najashi came and he looked on the floor and there was a twig. And he picked up the small twig. And he said, the difference between us and you is no different. What you said and what we're saying is no difference than this little twig. First, he was saying that the messages are two rays emanating from the same light. Meaning that it's the same source. Right? Kind of like a perennial type of, you know, philosophy. Now he realizes that, yes, there is a little bit different. He said, but at the same time, he's saying, what you said, right? And what Prophet Isa said, according to us, is no difference. There's no difference between them, this little tiny twig. There's a few different ways we're expressing it, yes. But at the same time, it's the same. So he said that, I'm not going to give these people up. You guys have to go back. And he returned all the gifts as well. All the people, give them all their gifts back and tell them to go ahead. These people can stay here. Now that they can stay here, what happened? A second migration to Abyssinia. Now another group of Muslims, in fact, much more, many, many Muslims migrated to Abyssinia. It's said that this time, first time was like a dozen. Second time was like 80, 90 Muslims migrated afterwards. Why? Because now it's clear, it's open. It's very clear. He said, no problem. Anyone who wants to come from Mecca here, they can go ahead and stay here. What effect did this have on the Quraysh? Huge humiliation. This was a big defeat for the Quraysh and a giant success for Islam. This was a big success for Islam and a defeat for Quraysh. Any questions? They had a translator. They had a translator, number one. Number two, it's very, very likely, and in fact, many historical books say that Najashi knew at least some Arabic, if not, because he, you know, the fact that he was trading and he had been around, he had been in Arabia as well, with armies and all of that. So it's very, very likely that he knew quite a bit of Arabic.
Yeah. Okay. That's something that we can't get into the details of, right?
In terms of, can this incident be used to live in a non-Muslim country? Right? The whole debate is, it's not about living in a Muslim or non-Muslim country, or you can live in a Muslim country but not be allowed to practice Islam. Right? The thing is, if you're allowed to practice Islam, for the most part, freely in a country, then you're allowed to live there. Right? There's other lessons you can learn from this, but in terms of all the details and all, we could go into a long, long discussion. We don't want to go into that. But it's a very important event, yeah. It's not really about what differentiates Islam or what makes it the same. The point was not to make it the same. The point is to mention beautiful things about Islam, right? That someone's going to understand that, you know what, this is something really nice and amazing, right? So if you go and you go into like an environment where everyone's kind of cutthroat and all of that, and you say, well, you know what, Islam teaches us to smile to our brothers and sisters, and they're not seeing many smiles, for example, then this is something, oh, wow, you have to smile, that's an act of worship, that's really interesting. And then you mentioned something about like taking care of family, and this guy's from a broken family. He said, wow, that's part of Islam? I was abused when I was a kid or something like that. They're going to be able to relate to it. So the point is to relate to the people that you're speaking to. It all depends. It's not to just appease them or have something in common with. It's to explain to them something that will, you know, get through to them that, oh, that's awesome about Islam. Rather than just giving them something very generic and talking about something like up there that they can't really, they're like, oh, okay, that's nice to know, or that's interesting. Something a little bit more powerful. Sure. How about we'll take a 5-minute break? Sound good?